you know, people here, they don't get too freaked out. And I don't think they're buying totally into the fact that this is a life-changing historic event that's about to happen.
North and South Korea's leaders prepare to meet in Panmunjom, but will it bring real change? It's Friday, April 27th. This is VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Remember, you're part of our program. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also, Mike Pompeo is confirmed as the new U.S. Secretary of State. A decision looms on the Iran nuclear deal. How will that affect Korean negotiations? And what's the difference between rice people and wheat people? Find out on today's VOA Asia. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is set to greet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the military demarcation line separating their countries later today as the leaders hold a rare summit. This first inter-Korean summit in more than a decade marks a dramatic turn toward diplomacy to resolve the growing North Korean nuclear threat. It comes after a two-year period of continuous North Korean nuclear and missile tests. VOA's Steve Miller spoke with our Seoul correspondent, Brian Padden, about the preparations and what both sides and the world are looking for out of the meeting.
Today, we got a good rundown from South Korean officials on the schedule of events for tomorrow. And it seems to be long on pomp and circumstance, but so far a bit short on substance. Kim Jong-un is going to cross the military demarcation line at 8:30 in the morning. He'll be met there by South Korean President Moon Jae-in. The two will review an honor guard that will be waiting for. There'll be a ceremony, a reception ceremony with an honor guard review. This is similar to how North Korea received the president of South Korea during the previous two summits that were held in the North. And so they will follow a bit of that format. There'll be a tree planting ceremony. There'll be a photo op. They may take a walk along this footbridge that crosses the border. This historic footbridge that was called the Bridge of No Return, in which prisoners from the Korean War were exchanged at the end of the war in 1953. So we have a list of all of these activities. There'll be two meetings. There'll be a morning meeting and an afternoon meeting. At the end of the day, there will be a joint communique. The expectation is that the major focus of this summit will be on denuclearization, and not only serving up a joint commitment to remove all nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula, but to also detail what that would mean, and perhaps set the tone and maybe set a framework for the next summit that's coming, which would be between Kim and U.S. President Donald Trump.
Does South Korea have any other expectations from this meeting, whether it be discussions on human rights or perhaps a commitment to allow families who are separated by the Korean War to meet?
There will be some focus on the family unifications, on exchanges, on cooperation. But unlike in past summits, South Korea is quite restrained in what it can offer in these summits. The international sanctions imposed prohibits South Korean President Moon Jae-in from actually offering any economic cooperation. They also said in the Blue House that human rights will not be addressed at this particular summit, to the dismay of a number of defectors and advocates for human rights and these issues. Also, they will talk about a possible peace treaty to replace the armistice that was signed over 60 years ago to end the war, and a peace treaty that would work to kind of ease relations and improve kind of security exchanges of information and those types of things. But a peace treaty also cannot be done between North and South Korea alone. That would require the other countries that signed the truce back then, which would include China and the United States.
If we pull back from Panmunjom and take a look at the individuals living in South Korea, how are they viewing the meeting tomorrow?
I think there is optimism here, more so probably than in the United States, where at least from my distance, I'm hearing a lot of skepticism. I think there's a lot of support for the outreach to North Korea here. I mean, President Moon was elected last year with a very strong majority. And so I think people are somewhat optimistic, but you know, people here, they don't get too freaked out. The tensions are high, and I don't think they're buying totally into the fact that this is a life-changing historic event that's about to happen. There's very much a wait-and-see attitude.
VOA's Brian Padden talking with our Steve Miller. John Delury is an associate professor in Chinese studies at South Korea's Yonsei University. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that time will tell if concrete action will follow the talks, but he sees a different kind of leader in Kim Jong-un than his father or grandfather.
Well, I would say there are two big changes. Kim Jong-un is quite different from his father. For example, on economic issues, he didn't grow up in the good old days when the socialist economy really worked for North Korea. And so he has a fundamentally different orientation. He's letting a lot of the market capitalist tendencies go. He's more similar to the kinds of leaders that we see in China and Vietnam when it comes to economic growth. And just recently, a couple days ago, he came out and made a very big declaration to his people to say we are 100% now focused on the economy. And then the second thing I would say is Kim Jong-un himself has evolved over his 6 years of power. I think the primary reasoning for the timing that this is happening now is the simple fact that he feels secure enough in terms of his domestic politics, that he knows where the levers are, that he can move his system. And so that's why we're seeing Kim Jong-un move in a new direction.
Yeah, but is he willing to give up nuclear weapons? There's supposed to be the third rail, if you will, in North Korean policy.
Well, denuclearization, you know, obviously is the $100,000 question. He's already made verbal commitments that were new in terms of saying he's ready to talk to the Americans about denuclearization. And we've heard that from the South Koreans credibly. We've heard it from the Chinese. You know, we're not going to really know Kim Jong-un's position and what he's ready for until he gets in that room with Donald Trump. You know, so the logic of the Trump administration is correct, that you put the summit first rather than dangling it out as the carrot. But I see enough in the underlying interests that are driving Kim Jong-un that he wants security for his regime, of course, for his country, but he also wants economic development and he wants new relationships. He wants a better relationship with the South and a better relationship with the United States. So I see plenty of room in those underlying interests for a negotiation led by Donald Trump and the Trump administration, where you get real steps that's moving toward real denuclearization. Now, the big issue is going to be the pacing of those steps, the verification of those steps, and the reciprocality. You know, what is the United States and what are South Korea prepared to do when? So this is where it becomes an incredibly complex, difficult negotiation. But I do see enough in the underlying interests and in the political will of the key actors that we could get a breakthrough and some real progress.
John Delury said a new element in these talks is the Moon administration's determination to move both inter-Korean ties and U.S.-North Korean relations forward in tandem. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. China cautiously optimistic about North-South Korea talks. Fighting in Kachin highlights Myanmar's civil war worries. U.S. probing alleged atrocities against Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims. World Bank disputes U.S. audit of Afghan reconstruction program. And Pakistani activists say social media policies are exploited for censorship. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. We're glad you're with us on VOA Asia on this Friday. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Former CIA Director Mike Pompeo was sworn in Thursday as the new U.S. Secretary of State. A divided Senate voted 57-42 to confirm President Donald Trump's nominee. All the Republicans backed him, and all but six Democrats and one independent lawmaker opposed him. President Trump hailed the confirmation and congratulated Pompeo on his new job. Pompeo replaces Rex Tillerson, whom Trump fired last month. The former CIA director is known for a more hawkish stance on foreign policy. VOA Cindy Sain joined us now to discuss Mike Pompeo's new role. Cindy, welcome.
Thank you.
As I mentioned in that intro, Mike Pompeo is a more hawkish stance. He's not afraid to be more belligerent when he relates to other countries. How do you think that that will affect negotiations with the Chinese, the North Koreans, people in Southeast Asia?
Well, that's a very good question. And some Democrats in the Senate had expressed concern about that very thing. Some had voted for him to be the CIA director, but they said on the question of being the chief U.S. diplomat, then that person needs to use, of course, diplomacy as the main tool and military force as a last resort. And some of the statements he has made in the past, even suggesting he might support regime change in North Korea and saying that the same thing about Iran, have some, especially Democrats, very nervous.
You mentioned Iran. President Trump faces a decision next month on whether to stay in or back out of what's called the Joint Plan of Action, I believe, the Iran nuclear deal. And that could affect a proposed summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un if the United States backs out, right?
Yes, you're right. It certainly could, because one would think that Kim Jong-un would say, okay, if the U.S. is not going to stick to its promises, you know, one president signs a deal and then the next president comes along and pulls out of it, then what is it really worth? So that is a concern also for a lot of people. Of course, Pompeo, in trying to reassure senators, said that they are trying to fix the deal. So it's not quite clear whether, now that he is in a new role, whether he will try diplomacy first. But he has hit the ground running and is headed off to a NATO foreign minister's in Brussels and then to the Middle East just hours after being sworn in at the Supreme Court.
VOA's diplomatic correspondent, Cindy Sain. Cindy, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
For his part, President Donald Trump issued a statement on Thursday saying, having a patriot of Mike's immense talent, energy, and intellect leading the Department of State will be an incredible asset for our country at this crucial time in history. Happening now in Asia, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres Thursday announced the appointment of Christine Schraner-Borgener, Switzerland's ambassador to Germany, as his new special envoy to Myanmar. The announcement comes just days before the Security Council travels to Bangladesh for a first-hand look at the Rohingya refugee crisis. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on this Friday. I'm David Byrd in Washington. As the world watches the Korean summit and the prospect of denuclearization there, a decision on the Iran nuclear agreement looms in the future. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told the Senate Armed Services Committee Thursday that there has been no decision made on any U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. He said Washington is working with its European allies to see if there are ways to improve the pact. He said the United States recognizes the nuclear pact was an imperfect arms control agreement.
I think that their use of denial and deception to hide their nuclear weapons program, not their nuclear plan, their nuclear weapons program over many years, have them in a position of being suspect. I've read it now three times, all 156 pages or whatever it is, including since I got into this job, I was able to read the classified, the short classified protocol. And I will say that it is written almost with an assumption that Iran would try to cheat. So the verification, what is in there, is actually pretty robust.
Secretary Mattis said he realizes that withdrawing from the Iran deal could cause credibility problems for the United States ahead of a proposed summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But the secretary added he does not hold much faith in the Kim regime.
I also recognize that some people point out that this could impact on the North Korea negotiations, but I would say in that case, in light of Kim's family and himself breaking every international treaty, every agreement they've ever made, whether it be with the Republic of Korea or with the United States, I'm less concerned with that ripple effect right now. I think we need to focus on what is in the best interest of Middle East stability and the threat that Iran poses.
President Trump faces a May 12th deadline on whether or not to reimpose some of the economic sanctions that were lifted against Iran in exchange for limits on the country's nuclear development as part of the 2015 deal. French President Emmanuel Macron, who wrapped up a U.S. visit this week, said Wednesday he believes that President Donald Trump will pull the United States out of the nuclear agreement. In Moscow, Russian Foreign Ministry spokesman Natalia Makarova said that her government was concerned by recent remarks by President Trump about the Iran nuclear deal. She said, "We are seriously concerned by all of this. I'm referring to comments made by the presidents of the United States and France about the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action on the Iran nuclear program. Russia has repeatedly said that there is no possibility for some kind of revote for this document, changing it or enlarging it." Meanwhile, Israel's ambassador to the United States, Danny Danon, called on Trump Thursday to change the course on the current nuclear deal with Iran. He said the agreement's expiration date must be extended or eliminated and changes implemented in order to end Iran's role as the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world. Coming up, what's the difference between rice people and wheat people? Find out. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
We have this news from VOA Asia. A Pakistan court on Thursday jailed a man for 7 years in the country's first ever conviction for child pornography. Sadat Amin was found guilty by a Lahore court of being part of a global child pornography racket spread across Europe and the United States. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. Do you like rice or do you prefer wheat products like bread? Well, a new study says the way that our ancestors farmed may influence our behavior today. The research finds cultural differences between people in China's rice-growing south and its wheat-growing north. As VOA's Steve Barragona reports, the study authors identified those differences by watching people get around chairs at Starbucks.
Thomas Talhelm has a theory that rice farming creates a culture of interdependence unlike any other kind of agriculture.
Paddy rice grows best in standing water, so rice villages build irrigation networks to flood their fields. That means rice farmers have to coordinate their water use with their neighbors.
And since rice takes more labor than wheat, villagers often work collectively. Talhelm is an assistant professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago. He notes that while southern China has farmed rice for thousands of years, wheat has sustained the north.
Since this was how the majority of Chinese people lived their life day in, day out for generations, these farming patterns may well have influenced Chinese culture, giving the north and south different cultures.
Talhelm wanted to see if those cultural differences linger in today's urban China, or if modernization had overridden the old ways. He and his colleagues went to Starbucks cafes in two cities in the wheat-growing north and three in the rice-growing south. They put two chairs about a hip's width apart in high-traffic areas and watched how customers got past them. In rice regions, only about 5% of people moved chairs. About three times more did in the wheat regions. Talhelm says that difference is telling.
When people in independent cultures like the United States encounter a problem, they're more likely to want to change the environment to solve that problem.
But in interdependent cultures like Japan, he says, people are more likely to try to fit themselves into the environment, like by squeezing between chairs rather than moving them. Other factors like population density, income, age, gender, climate, or even disease prevalence did not explain the difference. Concordia University psychology professor Andrew Ryder says he would be less impressed if this were the only study on the issue.
you can only learn so much by watching people moving chairs in Starbucks. But once you put this study in the context of the other work that they've done, there's a picture emerging.
He notes the researchers got similar results when they tested thinking patterns among students from northern and southern China. Students from the wheat-growing north were more analytical. Those from the rice-growing south were more holistic thinking. There were even differences among students from rice-growing and wheat-growing parts of the same county. Ryder says it's a reminder that cultures can be quite different even within a single country. Next, Talhelm is testing the theory in India, another country with a big rice-wheat split. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
This news from VOA, the Trump administration has decided to end special protections for 9,000 Nepalese immigrants in the United States. Those people will have until June 24th of next year to leave or find another way to stay in the country to allow for an orderly transition. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. The freedom to wear whatever you want is taken for granted here in the United States, but some people's idea of fashion options is being viewed by others as condoning the repression of women. In her first television interview, a U.S. designer of Muslim clothing explains why she designed her line. VOA's Carolyn Prasuti has the story.
Lisa Vogel is more than just a few clicks away from her German Catholic roots in central Michigan.
Tell me if I poke you.
Okay. I think I only had like two Muslims that I know of that I grew up with in my school.
Vogel developed an interest in the Islamic faith through a photography project. She later converted and started designing the clothing she couldn't find in stores.
They don't cater to the religious requirements of a hijabi Muslim.
Vogel started the Verona Collection, a modest clothing line that features hijabs in what fashion bloggers describe as colors that pop.
Half of the May production is actually going to be shot this Friday.
She opened a retail store in Florida, but converted it to a warehouse after a major department store took notice. Macy's, yes, one of America's largest, oldest department stores, is carrying Verona on its website.
There's now women that look like me, or dress like me, I should say, being represented on Macy's.
Not everyone agrees with this arrangement. Some point to the women of Syria who burned their hijabs after the defeat of the Islamic State, or the Iranian woman who was jailed after removing hers in public.
Some tweets have demanded a boycott, one suggesting that Macy's is supporting the oppression of women.
Hey, do you want to try it on?
Sure.
Rather than backing down from the controversy, Vogel says she's offering Muslim women a choice.
What's happening overseas has nothing to do with me. It absolutely doesn't. I'm here just offering clothing options.
It's an option that could help Macy's, which closed 100 of its stores in the past 2 years. Globally, consumers spend about $250 billion on Muslim attire. But it's a sensitive topic for women who grew up in Iran, including women's rights activist Parvaneh Hosseini.
It is ignorant towards what hijab means in other parts of the world.
Hosseini says the store should take a stance against the enforcement of hijab. Despite repeated attempts, Macy's declined to speak with VOA. Vogel says she has no intention of dropping her clothing line to concede to critics. Instead, she's focused on making Verona a regular staple at more department stores. Carolyn Prasuti, VOA News, Orlando, Florida.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and on SoundCloud. You can download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. You can also find us at voanews.com and let us hear from you, either on VOA Asia Facebook or by email, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy your day.